to matter, Trout tells her. You've got to learn the feel of it. Seat of your pants. But the wings tilt when he is at the controls, too. It seems to her that a malevolent force lives in the clouds, something that tips them askew just to prove it can. Also, if Trout is so confident in the seat of his pants, she wonders why, when the cloud is serious, he turns them back, lands as soon as they can. Sometimes, irregularly and not often, she wakes on the sleeping porch to a dark figure standing over her, touching her shoulder. She never startles, always knows before she is even awake that it is Caleb. Does Jamie stir when she gets up and they go together to the cottage? If he does, he doesn't let on. Do you do this with Barclay McQueen? Caleb asks in the cottage's narrow bed. They are crowded in shoulder to shoulder on their backs. Near the ceiling, the wings of her model airplanes are chalky with moonlight. I don't do anything with him. You go see him. How do you know that? People know. I'm delivering what he orders from Stanley. What does he need from Stanley? He has all the booze in the world. He doesn't even drink. He's a bootlegger who doesn't drink. He acts like it's impolite to mention he's a legger. We pretend he's not. And we pretend he doesn't pay for my flying. He puts his hand between her legs. What would he say about this? Her imagination reels, returns an ominous red wash of feeling, like the glow of a forest fire over the horizon. I'd never tell him, not for anything. Do you like him? What do you care? She says. He is touching her more purposefully. He reaches for the envelope he has put on the windowsill that contains rubbers. They use them when they have them, or else he pulls out. The prospect of a baby makes them laugh with horror. Of course you like him. He's the one who let you fly. It's more than that. So you do like him. Shh. You like this too, though. Shh. In the winter, she learns to land on skis. It's not so difficult, though judging altitude is tricky, as a snowfield looks the same from 10 feet as it does from 100. Sometimes the moment of contact catches her by surprise. Then there is the trick of reversing the engine to stop, as the skis have no brakes. Sit and visit, Barclay says. In the cold months, they sit inside at the kitchen table. She is never sure whether Sadler is somewhere in the house, though once in a while a creaking floorboard might give him away. Barclay is careful not to touch her, but near him, her whole body is a receptor. His presence saturates her. She feels she has just emerged from cloud into a vibrant, revelatory world. Tell me about the flying, he says. She tells him in minute detail, pleased to have the chance. Jamie frets about the dangers, about Barclay. Caleb has no patience for technical details. Talking to Wallace is like talking to a mop soaked in gin. But Barclay listens to even her most involved technical treatises. He's never been up in an airplane. He doesn't like the idea of it. She's told him that someday she'll take him up. You'll like it, she says. You won't believe how much you can see. He says he's content with the view from a car. He asks broader questions about her life. He is polite but persistent, like a newspaper reporter. So this Barnstormer, he says, with a ridiculous name. Felix Breyfogel, it's not ridiculous. So this Frederick Borsnoggle flies over you and you almost fall off your horse, and after that, you just know you need to fly airplanes. Yes, deep down and without a doubt. My word, but why? I don't know. You must have some idea. She says, you know how you said I was someone you needed to know right from the start? Even when you had no idea who I was? He nods. It's the same. Love, she means. Love sprung from nothing. It can't be quite the same thing. Maybe not. But I wanted to see other places, too, and I realized an airplane would get me there. I keep telling you, you'll find Montana is as good a place as any. She gropes for how to make him see it her way, and I get tired of worrying about Wallace. I used to feel so guilty he'd been saddled with us, but lately I can't trust him to take care of himself. What about Jamie? I'd feel bad leaving it all on his shoulders. I mean, wouldn't you miss him? Awfully. Barclay is solemn. I told you I have a sister, Kate. I wish I could hold her life in my hands like an egg, make everything good for her. It's a burden, the wish itself and the fact it's impossible. That's what I mean. Things might be better without anyone to worry about. He leans forward, his folded arms sliding on the table. That's not true. That would be the most terrible loneliness. In the spring, she learns to land at night. Lights have been installed at the airfield. Trout teaches her to step hard on the rudder and whip around in a ground loop to avoid onrushing obstacles. She is usually close to the chalk line now, sometimes right on it. May 1930. Amy Johnson, age 26, daughter of a Yorkshire fish merchant, flies solo from Croydon Aerodrome, just south of London, to Darwin, Australia, in a de Havilland Gypsy Moth. 10,000 miles in an open biplane at 80 miles per hour, always too hot or too cold, sunburned and reeking of gasoline. When she takes off, she has only 85 hours of flying experience and no knack for landings. But she has a ground engineer's license, knows about engines. Near Baghdad, a sandstorm forces her down, and she sits on the plane's tail with a revolver, goggles caked with sand, listening to what might be the howling of wild dogs, might only be the wind. She breaks the speed record to Karachi but smashes a wing. Repairs take time. In Rangoon, she smashes another wing, the undercarriage and the propeller. More repairs. The whole trip takes 19 and a half days, the last spent fighting headwinds for 500 miles across the Timor Sea, worrying about fuel. Then Darwin and fame, but not the speed record she'd wanted. As Marion's 16th birthday approaches, Trout says it's time for real mountain flying. Finally. They follow canyons, ride updrafts over ridges. Treetops whip by just under the wheels. She learns there is another landscape above the rocks and trees, an invisible topography made of wind. She learns if she flies straight at the lee side of a ridge and doesn't rack off in time, the air will turn to quicksand, sucking her down. To practice landings, they go to some of the wilderness strips where Trout hands off cargo to the bootleggers. She has to land short, real short. Trout bemoans that he can't teach her more advanced aerobatics. The big girl's no good for it, he says about the travel air. But you ought to have some practice. When things go wrong, you'd be calmer in your head if you were used to being turned every which way. Trout says, you've got to practice spins so you know how to get out of them, she tells Barclay. He says a pilot needs to learn not to panic. He says your reactions get faster. She knows what she is doing, what she is asking for, what will happen. In a few weeks, she arrives at the airfield, and there, beside the travel air, is a brand new, bright yellow Stearman biplane. Trout's smile hangs between his ears like a ragged hammock. But while they walk around the plane to admire its gleaming sleekness, the dashing set of its wings, he says in an undertone, "You sure about this, kid?" She is beginning to understand how Wallace built his debts. Just this one last thing, she tells herself. Then she will be ready to start flying across the line, paying down her debt. At least this way I'll learn some stunts, she tells Trout. Trout sits in the front cockpit and Marion behind, both in helmets and goggles and parachutes, harnessed in over the shoulders. The steerman has a stick instead of a wheel, and at first she's awkward with it. "From the elbow, not the shoulder, or you'll pull at an angle," Trout said on the ground. "You have to learn the feel of it." The great unifying thesis of his instruction. She likes the way the open cockpit fits snugly around her, how her legs extend out to meet the rudder pedals. She likes her face in the wind. Their third time up, the stick jerks in her hand, Trout signaling he wants to take over. He climbs high, starts a dive. As Trixie Brayfogle had, he pulls up into a loop, but this time, Marion is not watching the tumbling sky and ground. She watches the gauges. They level out again. Without turning to look at her, Trout raises both hands to tell her she is back in control. He'd already talked her through it. The necessary altitude and airspeed, the RPMs, the limits of all these things, the lightness and slowness she would feel at the top, the dive back toward the earth. "A loop is just another turn," Trout says, "only it's flipped up on its side." She climbs, begins her dive. "I flew a loop," she tells Jamie on the sleeping porch. "Three, actually." Her heart races as though she were confessing a secret, though she won't tell him how she had gone to see Barclay afterward, how, when he opened the door, she had grasped him around the neck and kissed him. A heavy pause, then, grudgingly, Jamie asks, "What was it like?" "Promise not to laugh." "I might laugh." "But I felt like I was a fixed point, and I was using the controls to make the rest of the world turn around me. I was literally the center of the universe." He laughs. "You feel that way all the time, though." She laughs, too. "Maybe I am the center of the universe. Did you ever think of that?"
"Aren't you worried about what he wants?"
"Yes. But mostly because I don't know what exactly that is."
"Seems obvious to me."
"If I thought all he wanted was to take me to bed, I'd be relieved. That would be simpler." But she does know what he wants, or thinks she does. "You have to learn the feel of it." The dive had made her heavy. Then, at the top of the loop, she had floated free in her harness. Barclay had clutched her to him, lifting her boots off the ground. With her mouth covered by his and her body clamped against his, and not even the reassurance of the porch under her feet, the determined impulse that had propelled her to kiss him collapsed into alarm and claustrophobia. He seemed to have gone blind and dumb, like a salmon beating muscularly upstream, driven by instinct. She writhed to get free, and for a second or two it seemed he would not let her go. She twisted, arching her back, and the movement seemed to wake him. He dropped her so abruptly she stumbled.
"I'm sorry,"
he said, breathless, holding up his hands as though to prove he was unarmed.
"You surprised me. My guard wasn't up."
She tried to steady herself. "It's all right." They looked anywhere but at each other. Marion went to sit on the edge of the porch, and he followed, sat beside her. She said, "I came to tell you I flew a loop today."
"I heard Trout got a new plane, one that's good for aerobatics."
A kingly smile. "He said Mr. Sadler wanted another for his collection."
This was the closest allusion she had made to Barclay's patronage, the boldest of her darting forays toward the truth. "Sadler's quite an aviation enthusiast," Barclay said. "He's got terrific taste in biplanes. He says he has a promising pilot." Her pleasure at hearing another person affirm her destiny bordered on ecstasy. Barclay had given her Trout. He'd given her a plane, and now he was offering his belief. She asked, "Is your guard up now?"
"Enough? Why?"
This kiss was not a straitjacket like the last one, but a gathering in. She was aware of his slow breathing, of how, when he leaned just a little bit away, she followed without meaning to. Something bound her to him, a rough pull, strong and coarse as rope. He pulled away.
"I can't play at this, Marion," he said. "We can't start down this road. You'd better go. And next time you come, we'll go back to being how we were before."
That would have been the moment to ask what he wanted from her. But she didn't need to. "He wants to marry me," she says to Jamie.
"He said so?"
"I just know." "Does that make you feel any better?"
"No."
"Me neither."
"Why does he want to?"
"Thanks a lot."
"Come on." "Why? You're just a kid."
"I'm not."
"Of course you are."
"I recognized you as someone I needed to know." She says, "I happened to catch his attention in a certain way, and once he has an idea in his head, he doesn't let go."
"So you have one thing in common, at least. Are you going to marry him?"
The elation of the loop is gone. Only the plunging sensation of the dive remains. She wishes Jamie would tell her not to, that she doesn't have to. She wishes he would imply Barclay is buying her, so she could rage at the idea, drive it away. She wishes he would ask if she loves Barclay, and she could say she thinks she might. And she does love Barclay, perhaps, or at least strongly desires him. But she also senses she is inside a trap, the dimensions and mechanism of which remain concealed. But Jamie knows better than to do any of these things. In the light from the moon, she can see him watching her with the melancholy of someone who has cared for and released a wild animal, hoping it will find its way on its own.
"Probably I'd better,"
is all she says. September again. She is 16, flying every day now. When she can't fly because of weather, she trails after the mechanics, learns to make repairs. "Like a fish to water," Trout says about her knack for stunts. That is how she feels, too, doing aerobatics. Like she has been delivered to her natural element after a cruel separation. No thoughts of Barclay intrude, or of Caleb, or Wallace, or Jamie. In the biplane, she is always the fixed center of the universe, wheeling it around herself with stick and rudder. Vril. Get up high, throttle back almost to a stall. Kick the right rudder, yank the stick back and to the right, spin down, engine hollering, tail up, violence in the fall. Earth revolving below like the dome of a twirling umbrella. Slow roll. Keep the nose aimed at a fixed point. Push the stick to the right. When the wings have gone vertical, start cross-controlling with the left rudder. Come off the left rudder, push the stick forward. You'll be hanging in the straps as the plane inverts. Your feet will want to fall away from the rudder pedals, but you can't let them. Then, all of it in mirror image, quickly, as the engine can't be trusted while upside down. It's like riding a bicycle in one direction with your hands and another bicycle in the opposite direction with your feet. Stall turn. Trout doesn't want to teach her this one, so she reads up and tries it out solo. Bank up vertical until the airspeed falls away to nothing, then just before gravity catches you,
left full rudder to cartwheel over the wingtip. Feed it right stick, then forward. Pivot until you're zooming nose down toward the earth. Pull out level. Trout is angry. Says he's seen good pilots crack up that way. He won't let her fly for a week. Not until she brings him a few bottles of moon and promises not to do it again. They both know she's lying, but a truce is made. There is more, of course. Immelman turns and bunts and barrel rolls and chandelles and all of them strung together, one leading into the next as she ties gigantic, elaborate knots over Missoula, plunging in and out of the lost glacial lake. The flying service pilots and local hobbyists forget they'd refused to teach her. They call her the Red Baroness and Lindy Girl. They want her to go to Spokane to compete at an air show, but she has no license, and Barclay would not like her to draw attention to herself. When the weather cools, a shearling coat and heavy boots appear for her so she can keep flying the open steerman. Another winter. More ski landings, more real mountain flying. A few close scrapes in the cloud, treetops brushing the skis, rocky escarpments narrowly missed. In March, Eleanor Smith, who'd flown the East River bridges, climbs to 25,000 feet over New York City in a supercharged Belanca, attempting to reclaim an altitude record. Frost forms on her breathing tube. Something goes wrong. Something comes uncoupled, or the air bottle cracks. Blackness drops over her like a hood. With an unconscious pilot, the plane descends more than 4 miles. At 2,000 feet, Eleanor woozes back into consciousness, manages to sideslip the plane down onto a bit of open land, noses over, walks away. That, says Trout, is nerve. A week later, Eleanor goes up again, hits 32,000 feet. Marion, sick with envy, circles the Travelair up to 15,000 feet, a little higher. Its ceiling is 16,000, but she thinks the specs are probably conservative. The engine sputters and skips and pops. She adjusts the mix, but can't get it to smooth out. It runs like a three-legged horse. Spooked, she eases down. Lucky, Trout says when she confesses. Go too high and you get drunk. There's a kind of crazy up there. You'll start seeing things. You'll think someone's in the plane with you. You'll see another ship out the corner of your eye just off your wing when none's there. She needs something to do, she tells Trout. She tells Caleb. She tells Jamie. She cautiously intimates to Barclay. She can really fly now. Trout has drilled her and drilled her, made her land on the tiniest patches of scrub grass and mountain gravel. She could probably land on a fence post like a hawk and take off from it, too. I could fly over the line, she insists to Trout. I want to be useful. I'm all trained up, she says to Caleb, but for what? They won't let me help run the booze. I can't compete at stunts without a license. I can't go anywhere. What's the point? And we're still acting out this charade, she says to Jamie, where Barclay has nothing to do with any of it. He's a kindly cattle rancher, and I'm the delivery girl who stops by to chat. What's the point?
You said he likes things his way, said Jamie. If he didn't want you to be in the charade, you wouldn't be.
In February, Amelia Earhart had married George Palmer Putnam, her publisher and promoter, some say her Svengali. He'd proposed 6 times. On their wedding day, she wrote him a letter saying neither should expect fidelity, and that sometimes she would need to be apart from him and from the confinements of marriage. She asked him to promise to let her go in a year if they weren't happy together. Marion knew nothing of this, of course. Could not dream of such a bargain. Before her 17th birthday, 3 important flights. First, weather comes in. Trout flying the travel air, spirals out of cloud, can't regain control. At least, that seems the most likely explanation. There isn't much left of him. Marion spends a long night in the cottage drinking real scotch, doing her best to harden herself. Hadn't Trout told her all pilots had dead friends? Hadn't he said she could end up being a dead friend herself? At his funeral, she barely looks at his wife and children, all of them short and froggy and miserable. Barclay promises he'll do right by them. She tells herself Trout had gone out the way he'd wanted. The final crack-up. Probably he wasn't even afraid. Was too focused on trying to fix what was wrong. Probably it had happened too fast for him to feel any pain. His body had been badly burned. His front teeth had been embedded so far in the dash, they'd stayed there when they pulled the rest of him out. Barclay had sent her a black dress to wear to the funeral. Fine, soft wool trimmed with black grosgrain ribbon, small, shiny black buttons. She wears her flying clothes instead. Jamie sits beside her. Barclay, in the next pew forward, ignores them until the very end. When he turns around and offers his hand to Jamie, says, "Peace be with you." Jamie says with a dueler's grim resolve, "And also with you." Afterward, she goes to the green and white house with the dress still in its box. "You can have this back," she tells Barclay. "I didn't wear it." "I noticed," he says, ushering her into the kitchen. "You didn't like it." "Trout would have laughed at me from heaven." She drops the box on the table. "You believe in heaven?" "No." "So, what do you think happens?"
"I think nothing happens. Is Sadler here?"
"Mr. Sadler has business in Spokane."
"It's time for me to start flying over the line. I know where the landing strips are. I've practiced on them. Without Trout, I'm the only one who can do it."
He leans against the sink and lights a cigarette. "That's not true. The country is lousy with pilots."
"It was my condition from the beginning. You know it was."
"Marion, I never agreed to your so-called condition."
She gapes at him. "You did. You let me keep taking lessons."
"You can't assume you have a deal with someone just because you issue a decree."
"I said I didn't want lessons unless I knew I had a way to work off what I owe you. It's not fair otherwise."
Amused. "Not fair, you should have what you most wanted."
"Not fair, you won't give me a way to pay you back."
"Isn't it a little unseemly to try to leverage Trout's death into a flying opportunity the very day of his funeral?"
"His number came up," she says, defiant. "He always said it could."
He smokes, watching her. "Are you really this hard?"
"Trout would have said I was ready. I know the mountains. You know you can trust me. If not this, then let me drive for you. Let me do something. I'll go back to collecting bottles, anything. I feel like some rich man's daughter, or like I've been taught to fly just because it's funny to see a girl in an airplane, like a dog walking on its hind legs."
A long silence. He offers his gaze as a kind of challenge. She holds it. Finally, he says, "I don't think of you as a daughter or a dog." He shifts, stubs out his cigarette in an ashtray. "But the biplane can't hold much cargo anyway. I don't think it's worth the risk."
Like that, without fanfare, the charade is over. "It holds 30 cases," she says, "maybe a few more. Trout told me. That's not nothing if it's premium brands. And you'd keep your air routes open in case you wanted to get a bigger plane again."
"It's not enough to justify putting you on the wrong side of the law."
"I've been on the wrong side of the law for years," she says, feeling blustering, silly.
"But not on my account." She tries to interrupt. He cuts her off.
Just this one little time, Marion. I won't give you what you want. Not right now.
But soon? Hesitantly, he rests one hand on her shoulder, squeezes gently as though testing fruit.
If a pilot with Trout's experience died, how can you know it won't happen to you?
I can't, but I have to do it anyway.
If anything were to happen to you, I would never forgive myself.
It wouldn't be your fault.
She steps so close her left foot is between his feet.
Let me jump the line, please.
He seems almost as though he will agree, but recovers himself, moves away. Don't do that.
Do what?
Don't offer yourself. You're the one trying to buy me. I'm not trying to buy you. I'm trying to help you.
Then help me by letting me be useful.
She storms off, out the door. He doesn't follow. That night in the cottage with Caleb, she does what she has not done before. She fucks him. She has never before associated that word with what they do, but now it fills her head. She sits atop him, furious, gouging with her hips. At first, he responds in kind, but then turns passive and watchful. At the end, he pushes her off, comes into an old washing flannel. She has struck the wall, not hard, but she shouts at him. He covers her mouth with a hand and she bites. Part of her wishes he would slug her like he did when they were kids. But even as he yanks his hand back, grimacing in pain, she knows he won't. Instead, he pulls her roughly to his chest, holds tight until she quits fighting. She thinks he is waiting for her to cry. She will not. She can't. Eventually, they fall asleep. At dawn, after he is dressed, he sits on the edge of the bed, his hair loose down his back. We have to stop this, he says. Whatever you have with him, you have to sort it out. I can't help you with it.
No, she says. No one can.
Second, the plan is not a reaction to Trout's death. She had been mulling it over for months, but she hesitated because of how worried Trout would be and because she'd feared Barclay would blame him. Now the consequences are only hers. On a clear June morning, she takes off in the biplane, fuel tank only half full. Nothing out of the ordinary, nothing to draw attention. She purls up a lazy loop. When she's leveled off again, she turns northwest, following the railroad. Jamie has disappeared for the summer. A few weeks before, at the end of May, Wallace had found a note from him on the kitchen table that said he was going away but would come back in time for the start of school. They shouldn't worry. Marion was hurt he had left without telling her, then envious. She might have gone with him if she'd known. Then she was hurt afresh by the thought that he hadn't told her for exactly that reason. A map is pinned to her knee, the route already plotted. She'd left a note of her own in the hangar, gone cross-country, back tomorrow. She knows Barclay has spies who will find it when she doesn't come back. After that, lickety-split, he'll have his people calling every airfield for 3 states in all directions, promising an irresistible reward for any information about any lone girls in Stearman biplanes. She'd left the note only because otherwise he'd have filled the sky with search and rescuers. She turns north again, follows the Clark Fork up to Lake Ponderay. She sets down outside a nothing town where she's been before, not far from a gas station she's scouted. The owner has a fuel truck, comes out to fill her tank. A risk, but unavoidable. Off she goes, west, then north, following the Ponderay River. When it bends to meet the Columbia, she knows she is over Canada. She carves her way west, low among the mountains, her wings paring air off the slopes. The weather mostly holds. For a while, there is a thick, low mat of cloud, and she stays above it, tobogganing the airplane's belly along the top, the prop half buried in the mist. This is what she has always wanted. Choose a point on a map and fly to it. She thinks Jamie probably also went west, toward the sea. Before he left, she'd woken one night to him gently shaking her. "You were having a nightmare," he'd said. She'd been dreaming about Trout. She'd been with him in the travel air, spiraling down, and Trout was pleading with her to help him, but her controls didn't seem to be attached to anything. "I was dreaming about Trout."
"I figured you were talking."
The spring night was rustling and chilly, and she scooted over so Jamie would slide in, head to toe with her. She said, "Do you think Trout was afraid?"
"Wouldn't you be?"
"I want to think he wouldn't have been, but I don't think it works that way."
"It would have been quick, at least."
"Even if he'd known for certain what was going to happen, I don't think he would have stopped flying."
"Not for his kids?"
She shook her head. "I hope he at least knew Barclay would make sure his family was all right." They were quiet. She added, "Whatever he felt, it's done now." But Jamie was asleep. More snowcaps appear as she flies on. The country's emptiness pleases her. She is less likely to be spotted. After some hours, she descends into a long open valley checkered with farmland. Mountains to the north. The city of Vancouver standing up to the west. Beyond, water blues the horizon. The Strait of Georgia. She wants to fly out over it, over Vancouver Island to the open ocean, but she doesn't have enough fuel or daylight. She chances an airfield north across the harbor from the city. When the pilots hanging around ask where she's come from, she says Oregon. She asks where she should leave the plane for the night, where there is a cheap hotel. They look at her funny, but she stares back hard. She can't pass for a boy anymore, and has no choice but to be an odd, tall, dusty, freckled girl, raccoonishly suntanned from her goggles, with short cropped hair. A man takes a grease pencil and a notepad from the pocket of his overalls and writes down directions to a rooming house a couple of miles away. "Tell Geraldine that Sawyer sent you," he says, tearing off the page. "She's a nice lady. I'll keep an eye on your plane. What's your name?"
"Funny. My name's Geraldine, too," Marion says. She points to the north and the bigger mountains. "Do you ever fly up in there?"
He shakes his head. "Not much there for me."
Geraldine's is halfway up a steep hill. "Be in by midnight," Geraldine says. "No guests and no drinking in the house." In Marion's room, a window frames fading twilight, a line of dark blue sea cutting across the gaps between the houses. Restless, she sits on the bed, stands at the window, sits again. A knock at the door. She opens it to Geraldine holding out a folded nightgown.
"I noticed you didn't have any luggage. I thought you might need something to sleep in."
The gesture is simple. But Marion is not used to being cared for.
"Thank you,"
she says, clasping the garment to her chest. Her voice betrays her by shaking.
"It's really nothing."
Geraldine is younger than Marion had expected. Almost as blonde and freckled as herself, but soft and bosomy.
"You all right?"
For a moment, Marion wants to tell her everything. To pour out the tale of her parents and her uncle and Barclay McQueen and Trout. She would tell Geraldine she is only 16 and is flown here from Montana by herself, and tomorrow she is going to fly out over the ocean just to look around, to see something. Geraldine will say she wished she were half as brave. But instead, Marion just says she's fine, that she hadn't been expecting to spend the night. Engine trouble is all. In the morning, she fuels the plane and takes off,
circles the field to get her nerve up. Then she follows the harbor out, passes over the strait, over Vancouver Island, and is finally over the sea. Wind draws a delicate pattern on the water like the weave of linen, overlaid by shadows of clouds. Well out from shore, she longs to fly on, even though the horizon will only ever recede. But she knows she has to turn around, to go home and face what must be faced. She tells herself at least she's seen the ocean. Flying back, she turns up an inlet toward the mountains. Tells herself she's just following a whim, though it's more like a dare. At the end of the sound, the water is bright and milky from a river disgorging glacial meltwater, braided with pale sand. She follows it north. The mountains are more rugged than any she's seen. All the other cross-country entries in her logbook were only puny feints against the great immensity of the planet, but this is real mountain flying. She should turn around, be on her way back to Montana. But gunning the engine, pulling her scarf up over her mouth and nose, she ascends. 12,000 feet. She flies at a snow-covered saddle, crosses over it into a high bowl. Rock and blue ice loom up, hemming her in. Below, crevasses fissure an ice field. The widest looks big enough to swallow the plane whole. In places, the snow has broken through and there is blackness underneath. The engine catches, sputters with disapproval. She tries to circle up and out, but the plane is sluggish, heavy. She adjusts the mix, but still the engine protests, begins to miss. Her heartbeat seems to miss too. A stiffness creeps into her limbs, her armpits prickle. She circles and circles. The cold wind on her face feels as sharp and violent as glass shards. Her arms are so heavy. She can barely work her feet on the rudder. No one will ever find her. No one will even know where to look. The blackness at the bottom of the crevasse will swallow her. Snow will shroud her. But on the other hand, then no one will know how foolish she'd been to come into these mountains. She will not give them her broken body, will not leave her teeth stuck in the dashboard of the plane. Barclay will have no recourse but to wonder. In his mind, a phantom version of herself will go on living 1,000 different imagined lives in 1,000 different places. He won't be able to consign her to the past, to the ranks of the dead. The engine misses badly. The plane dips woozily. Jamie will never know what a lonely, needless death she's contrived for herself. The thought of Jamie strikes her like a slapping hand. The buzzing in her head clears. No. No, she will not leave him alone in the world, will not punish him for his summer escape by vanishing forever. Willing movement into her leaden arms and legs, pressing into her own body as though shifting a heavy weight, she pushes the stick forward and dives, following the curvature of the bowl. When she is barely skimming over the ice, she pulls up, rattling and sputtering, just barely, she clears the opposite ridge. Descending, her hands and face thaw. Terror comes alive in her. She trembles hard enough on the controls to make the plane bobble. She turns south. The pilots in Missoula are relieved, want to know where she'd gone. To Vancouver and back, she tells them, wooden. She'd had to spend another night out, sleeping in the plane in a field. Any good? One asks, perplexed by her flatness. It was all right. Why hadn't Trout told her about the blackness that lived in the depths of ice? McQueen is fit to be tied, another says. He was around all morning, looking up at the sky like he was about to go up there and tear down the whole damn thing. She's only been home an hour before Barclay shows up, driven in his long black Pierce Arrow by Sadler. At the door,
Wallace asks feebly what he wants.
I want a word with Marion.
Marion is listening from the stairs.
It's all right, Wallace, she says, coming down.
Without protest, her uncle shrinks back into the house. Marion leads Barclay to the cottage. He shuts the door behind them. His anger makes his freckles stand out. His eyes are almost black. In a quiet voice, he asks how she could have betrayed him so spitefully. She is stupid, foolish, selfish, and he never should have trusted her. Of course, it had been a mistake to allow her to fly. I should have known, he says, that you'd take everything I've given you and throw it back in my face.
Marion stands and listens without flinching. And when he is done, all she can do is cry.
She bends like a willow in the gusts of her own sorrow. He will think guilt is what racks her, won't guess it is grief. Grief for Trout, but also for the idea she'd had of herself as fearless in the air, of the sky as an ally rather than an indifferent immensity full of ungovernable forces. The fury goes out of him.
Don't cry, he says. Please, Marion. I was only angry because I was afraid I'd lost you.
He gathers her against himself.
Why did you do it?
He asks in a fervent murmur. Why would you run away like that?
I wasn't running. I wanted to go somewhere, like I've been telling you.
When she feels him start to pull away, she holds on, says,
I wanted to see the ocean.
And did you?
Only the edge.
It all looks the same.
She wants to explain the crevasse to him, how she had not crashed into it but had been swallowed nonetheless, but she only says,
I had a fright in the mountains.
Hurriedly, she adds, I went up a little too high, that's all. I learned a lesson. His arms tighten around her.
Sometimes you seem so wise and sometimes very foolish.
The warmth of his body intervenes between her and the ice, the blackness. She would have told Jamie about the crevasse if she could have, if he were there, and then she would have been fortified in her dealings with Barclay. But Jamie had left her behind, and Caleb had cut her loose. She presses her face into Barclay's neck. He goes very still. She says,
I've been having nightmares about Trout.
Again, she thinks he will tell her not to fly, even forbid it, but he says,
Don't expect yourself not to be troubled, Marion. Something would be wrong if you weren't.
His kindness, as Geraldine's had, makes her cry. But her tears are gentler now, a slow seep from under her lids, a fluttering in her abdomen. He kisses her just under her ear.
Does she regret the flight?
She decides she doesn't. She would have peered out of the cockpit and into something bottomless and unfathomable sooner or later. At some point, she would have found the edge of her own courage. There is nothing for it but to adjust, be humbled. So she is not exactly who she had thought. So what? She will be someone different. Barclay has one hand around her shoulders and the other lifting underneath her backside, hoisting her against him. Barclay is pressing her backward like a dance partner, guiding her toward the narrow bed. They are lying down. He has her trousers undone, his hand inside. She pushes back against him, slides her hips. His eyes are glassy, his expression slack. She keeps moving, holding his gaze. Outside, Sadler coughs. The sound is so clear, as though Sadler were sitting in the armchair a few feet away. Barclay snaps out of his reverie, removes his hand. Immediately, it seems impossible that they had, seconds before, been doing what they'd been doing. He stands up quickly.
I'm sorry.
She fastens her trousers.
For starting or for stopping?
Starting, he says as though it should be obvious.
Didn't you like it?
Too much.
Then why did you stop?
I have no right to compromise you like that.
She turns her head to the wall, waiting for him to leave, but he sits on the edge of the bed.
You're upset.
Outrage pours out of her. Yes, she tells him. She is. Why didn't he ever consider whether or not she liked it? Whether she wanted to stop? Why must she always be protected? He can't keep her safe against the dangers that matter, the darkness, the possibility of falling. His attempts are insulting, and it's outrageous for him to say he shouldn't compromise her. What had he done with his patronage and his airplanes except compromise her? What had he done except use her own dreams against her? And even when they both want the same thing, she stops, suddenly shy about admitting she wants him. Wants to see his body and to be touched, that she is not a virgin anyway. This last she must never say. Fucking would be more truthful, at least.
You want to? He hesitates.
I want to fly across the line.
That's all. His disappointment is plain.
And I want to go to bed with you. Shrewdness and thrill, stubbornness and lust, worry and smugness play over his face.
All right, he says, putting on his hat and opening the door. All right, fine. To both. Not today, but soon enough.
Third. Barclay agrees to be taken up. His first flight. On a hot July day, he arrives at the field and strides around nervously, scowling at the planes. He and Marion have not been to bed yet, but sex now seems like a trap door that may open under them at any moment. She has begun flying over the line. Sadler has taught her the code used for arranging pickups and shown her how to read a special map printed all over with tiny numbered dots. Most are just decoy nonsense, but some are real caches and landing strips.
You disapprove,
she'd said to Sadler. His eyes on the map, voice lilting like a man relating an item of mild interest from the newspaper, he said,
It's not my place.
Her first run had been to an anonymous farmer's field in British Columbia. The farmer had driven a tractor out to meet her, pulling a wagon stacked with cases of whiskey. The sun had been low when she took off again. The weight of the cargo made the fuel go quickly, shifting the plane's balance, and she'd had to keep a close eye on the trim. Briefly, the leadenness had come into her again, the blank, heavy, buzzing feeling. But it had passed quickly, never quite taking root. Only two cars were waiting for her small delivery, their headlights pinpricks in the dusk. They'd backed up close to the plane when she'd landed, and opened their trunks and also hidden compartments under the back seats. Brisk and businesslike, they'd hauled the cases out. In a few days, a message had come directing her next pickup. As Marion takes off and circles up, Barclay sinks low in the front cockpit until the top of the flying helmet she'd given him is barely visible. She banks steeply around the city, trying to tip him into looking down. But the little leather dome of him, glossy as a bullfrog's back, doesn't move. She can't even be sure his eyes are open. Her plan had been to go easy on him, take him on a pleasant aerial tour of the valley, but she's nettled by the idea that he might spend the whole flight hunkered down, stubbornly fearful. She pulls the stick back and punches it to the side, kicks the rudder. The plane turns tidily upside down. Barclay's head dangles out of the cockpit, and he clutches the edges as though he thinks he might be able to hang on like a crab or his harness to break. Another kick, and Missoula swings back down. He twists to look at her, shouts something into the wind, jabs his gloved finger down at the ground.
She smiles, turns the nose to the northeast. When he understands she is flying him out of town, he turns again, shouts again. But what can he do? He is at her mercy, and she has a full tank of fuel. After half an hour, Barclay, bored with being angry and afraid, is sitting up and looking out. He peers over one side, then the other. Eventually, the sawtooth ramparts of Glacier National Park come into view, overlapping rough blue ridges fading with distance. The sun catches the rock layers in the mountain sides. In some places, they lie in a flat stack. In others, are folded and wrapped like taffy on the mixing hook. Glaciers cling to the slopes, smaller than the ones she'd seen in Canada. Below are bright blue-green lakes of meltwater, opaque as enamel. She wonders if the fear will return, but she feels only a tightness in her throat that might just be anxiety about what will happen after they land. Before she flipped the plane, she had not considered how he might perceive the maneuver as another rebellion or betrayal, even mockery. Hopefully, Glacier's grandeur will soothe his temper. What would she do if, in punishment, he forbade her from flying the plane? She would leave Missoula, of course. For the first time, she wonders if he could stop her from leaving. If he would. The fuel needle drops lower and she steers back toward Kalispell. Barclay has not turned around again, has not acknowledged the wonders she has shown him. As they pass into the ordinary greatness of lesser mountains, she feels peevish and depleted, as though she'd stayed too long at a fair or picnic. Clouds are coming in, getting denser and lower. By the time they land in late afternoon, it is overcast. "We'll have to wait out the weather," she says to Barclay as he climbs out of his cockpit. She is casual, pretending she has not just kidnapped him and turned him upside down. He looks at the sky. Calmly, he says, "I have a place here, an office. We'll go there." As they walk into town, Barclay takes a ring of keys from an inner pocket of his jacket. "It's a good thing," he says. "This didn't fall out and land on someone's head back in Missoula." Anticipation hangs between them, making them awkward. The air is humid, thick with imminent rain. A man smoking in a doorway greets Barclay, and they exchange pleasantries while Marion stands off to one side, unacknowledged by Barclay. The stranger's gaze flicks curiously over her. The office is actually a small house on a side street. Only two rooms, close and warm. The first contains two desks with telephones and typewriters and lamps, a block of wooden filing cabinets, and a stove and sink. Everything is perfectly tidy. Barclay goes into the next room, a bedroom, and pulls the curtains shut with a brisk snap. She follows, tentative. "Does someone live here?" "No." He indicates a closed door. "You can go in there to clean up." The bathroom is floored in white octagonal tiles. There is a clawfoot tub, a sink, a toilet with a pull chain. In the mirror, she sees a wind-blasted urchin, face grimy except where her goggles had been, hair plastered to her head as tightly as a bathing cap. Clean up. She eyes the bathtub. Ought she to take a bath? Would that be strange? Would it be strange not to? She can smell oil and gasoline on her hands. They are, of course, about to go to bed together. How will she avoid starting a baby? He must have thought of that. He couldn't want a baby. She turns the tub's hot water tap, pees under cover of the noise. When the water is a few inches deep, she gets in, splashes, and dips like a bird in a puddle, tries to settle her heart. She puts her head under the faucet and does the best she can with the small cake of soap left beside the sink. She has the feeling of readying herself for a rite, a sacrifice. After she gets out, she hesitates, wrapped in a towel, debating, then puts her dirty flying clothes back on except her socks and boots, which she carries with her. He is sitting on the edge of the bed, but when she draws near, he gets up and goes into the bathroom, brushing past without a glance. She stands, bewildered, in the middle of the room, listening to him urinating. She goes to the window and peers through the gap in the drapes, holding her boots in front of her like an old woman with a handbag. She wants to lift the sash, let in some air, but feels she can't. The light outside has gone gray and the street is quiet. Now the sink runs and splashes. A black Ford trundles by. Water from her hair drips down her collar. Barclay's footsteps behind her. His chest is against her back, and he is reaching around and taking her boots from her and dropping them, unbuttoning her trousers, pushing them down, turning her. He unbuttons her shirt with shaking fingers. So speedily unveiled, she covers her breasts with one arm, but he pulls her arm away and tugs down her drawers. He steps back, looking at her. The ferocity of his interest makes him appear almost scornful. "Who are you?" She is not the girl she'd been at Miss Dolly's. She felt more exposed wearing those flimsy, borrowed clothes than she does now, naked. On the bed, it is strange to be naked while he is still fully clothed. She feels the roughness of his wool trousers against the insides of her legs, his belt buckle scraping her belly, the buttons of his shirt against her sternum. She tries to undo them, but he pushes her hands away. He seems to want her to lie still. When she caresses his neck or back, he seems almost to flinch. And so she leaves her hands at her sides until he lifts one and uses it to squeeze his penis through his trousers. He puts a finger inside her as he had before, but when she rocks against it, he glowers. Flattens his other hand hard on her stomach, holding her in place. She wants to ask how they will stop a pregnancy, but his stormy expression forbids it. Finally, in one abrupt chrysalis, he sheds all his clothes. His body is nearly hairless, though there are sparse dark nests in his groin and armpits. When he stands to get something from a pocket of his jacket, his penis stands out from his body like a spigot. With relief, she sees the thing he's fetched is a rubber. Miss Dolly's girls had told her the most difficult part about rubbers was getting anyone to wear them. The girls preferred pessaries, which they said were not always easy to come by. Barclay crawls onto the bed, nudges her legs apart with his knee. He pauses briefly, meeting her eyes, giving her a last chance to change her mind. The first sensation is one of adjustment, her groin muscles absorbing the strain of his weight, much greater than Caleb's, her internal architecture shifting. The feeling of him is obscure and distant, some message from a subterranean city. Yet as he moves, she begins to feel a gathering, a quickening, as though what they are doing is urgent and necessary, as though something important hangs in the balance. Maybe she had known this would be the consequence of turning the plane upside down. "Are you all right?" he says. "Yes." "Does it hurt?"
"A bit."
"You haven't done this before, have you?"
"No."
He stares at her. She can't tell if he believes her. Brusquely, he pulls out, turns her over so her face is engulfed in pillows and pushes into her unceremoniously from behind. After a moment, he rolls over, pulling her on top of him. Then he is pressing her onto her back again, pushing her knees up against her shoulders. As he arranges her limbs first one way and then another, he radiates itchy dissatisfaction, and she surrenders to the role of startled, silent bystander. What does he want from her?
He doesn't quite seem to know. She wonders if all his encounters are like this. If all his girls feel like dolls in the hands of an impatient, tyrannical little boy. He turns her over restlessly, puzzling at her body as though it contains the key to something he wants, but is not itself that thing. To her surprise, she finds his impersonal manipulations exciting. But he, fussing over the position of her arms, is beginning to have difficulty maintaining an erection. A possibility she hadn't ever considered. Placing her arms above her head and pushing them firmly into the mattress, as though telling them to stay put, he takes his softening member in hand and attempts to stuff it into her. Shit, he says, rolling off. He hunches on the edge of the bed, trying to chafe himself back into hardness. Did I do something wrong? She says. The movement of his arm ceases. I don't know how to trust you, he says. What should I do? Promise not to be with anyone else. I have. But what should I do now? He turns and looks at her until he seems to reach a decision. Drawing a long breath through his nose, he swivels to lie beside her. Holding her gaze, he fits his hand carefully around her throat. He does not squeeze, but her pulse flutters like a trapped butterfly. What follows is not entirely different from what had come before, but he is more decided. He holds her by the head, the hips, the wrists. He puts his penis in her mouth, something Caleb had never done. She is lost in a state of perpetual transition, exhilarated then nauseated, fearful then reckless, debased then venerated. He seems to want so profoundly. She thinks he might destroy her, break her like some small animal, and not even notice because what he wants is not actually in her, but beyond her, somewhere else, or perhaps doesn't exist. When he comes, it is with a terrible grimace. At some unnoticed point, it had begun to rain. He gets up to open the window, letting in the dusty smell of a summer storm. Are you all right? He says, returning to bed.
Yes.
I meant to be gentle. I'm sorry. She doesn't know whether or not he wants her to say it was fine. There's no blood anyway, he says, uneasy.
I spent a lot of time on horseback, she says.
He seems to accept this. He asks, do you know what a rubber does?
It's so I don't get pregnant.
She pauses.
You thought to bring one along?
I've been carrying it around just in case. How did you know about rubbers?
From Dolly's girls. Lucky that didn't fall out of your pocket and land on someone's head.
He is on his side, close to her. He rests his fingertips on her clavicle. Someday, of course, we'll want a baby.
Marion is taken aback. I've never thought about it.
This is the unadorned truth. Never once has she imagined herself cradling an infant. All girls want babies.
How would I fly if I had a baby?
He looks confused. You wouldn't. She is equally confused. For months, he'd listened to her talk about what she wanted. She'd never said anything about babies.
I have to, though, she says.
They look at each other in dismay. He puts one hand on her belly. Not yet. Someday.
I don't want to stop. Not ever.
You're young, he says in a patient tone. What makes you happy now is different from what will make you happy later. You must know that I love you. I'll take care of you. I'll marry you. These last are not posed as questions.
So he had never believed her.
He had been indulging a child's make-believe. A long blade of rage cuts through her,
but she stops herself from reacting by remembering flipping him upside down, making him afraid.
He'd thought he was reclaiming something when he put her face in the pillows, turned her body over and over like a pebble he was worrying in his pocket. But really, he was only accepting what she'd offered. He'd needed her to give him the imperative of reclaiming his dominance. And she had. Could there be power in submission? She will probably have to marry him, she knows. He will win their game of push-pull. But if she agrees now, she will lose too much. She says, "Not yet." She flies to Canadian farms and brings back cases of premium brands, learns more about the business. Barclay's interests and supply chains are diffuse and diverse. He buys from middlemen who buy legally from buzoriums scattered around Saskatchewan, Alberta, British Columbia, Manitoba. He has relationships with whiskey exporters in Scotland, with importers in Canada, with lawmakers and law enforcers. He has lawyers in Helena and Spokane and Seattle and Boise who cover his tracks and help out the little guys when they get caught. One afternoon, when they are in bed in the green and white house, he says, "I don't feel right about this."
"You seemed to enjoy yourself."
"That's not the point." Petulantly, "I wish you'd just agree. If you're going to eventually, why wait?" A pessary snugly cups her cervix. She thinks of the device as her small but stalwart ally. Cora from Miss Dolly's had gotten it for her at a steep price, of which Marion assumed a good chunk was commission. "Like this," Cora had said, pinching it between her fingers. "Then you shove it up yourself and let go. It'll pop into place." To Barclay, Marion says, "Only if you promise I can keep flying forever and never have any babies." She speaks lightly, but he doesn't smile. She tries again. "Why can't we go on as we are? Eventually you'll get tired of me and you'll be glad I'm just your pilot." He is serious, almost grim. "I have to hide almost everything I do. I want this to be on the up and up, respectable and official, and I want you to be respectable too."
"I'm not respectable?"
The sting surprises her. "I want you to be more secure, to have some kind of status in the world." He touches her cheek. "I don't want anyone ever to see you the way I first saw you. I thought you said I fascinated you. You did. You do. But that was something private between us. If anyone else had seen you like that at Miss Dolly's, there would have been a simple, sordid misunderstanding, but I saw through your little outfit." He props himself on an elbow. "It had to be me who saw you. I know it. I saw someone out of place who needed me but didn't know it yet. At first, I was relieved you were a whore because I thought I could have you. But then I was so much more relieved when I realized you weren't. I didn't want anyone else to have you." He rolls onto his back and pulls her against him with her arm over his chest, her leg over his thigh. "And what did you see when you first saw me?"
"A stranger."
"That's all?"
"Not quite."
She doesn't want to talk about Miss Dolly's anymore. She wishes the memory didn't loom quite so large for him. Her hand moves to his groin, and his breathing deepens. "What else?" he says.
"I saw a man who would let me fly his biplane as much as I wanted forever and ever."
"Yes," he says, but he means the motion of her hand. She had thought he might lose interest in her once she was plucked, no longer a figure of fantasy, but he hasn't. If anything, her enthusiasm for sex has made him more fixated on marriage. He seems jealous of the act itself. The first time she'd clenched and pulsed around him,
When they were in their second day of being trapped by rain and cloud in the Kalispell house and had gotten the hang of each other, he had stared at her in frank astonishment. He'd asked how she'd known how to do that. And she'd lied and feigned surprise and said it had simply happened. He'd told her not all women were capable of climax, and more important, not all men were capable of inspiring such phenomena. She was fortunate on both counts, he'd said. He'd asked her again if she'd been with anyone else, told her it was all right if she had, he only wanted to know the truth. No, she'd said, only you. There could be no other answer. His arm is around her. He is gripping her backside. You saw the man you'd marry, he says, his eyes half closed. But only maybe, she says, and not for a very, very long time. From there, the negotiations continue silently and are understood differently by each of them.